Καλησπέρα σε όλους και καλώς ήρθατε στον Αντίνο. Σήμερα είναι ιδιαίτερη χαρά και τιμή να είναι μαζί μου ο Ρώσος φιλόσοφος, διανοούμενος, πολιτικός επιστήμονας, κοινωνιολόγος, καθηγητής και επικεφαλής του Τμήματος Κοινωνιολογίας των Διεθνών Σχέσεων στο Πανεπιστήμιο της Μόσχας και ηγετικό πρόσωπο στο Διεθνές Ευρασιατικό Κίνημα. Δεν πρόκειται για άλλον από τον Αλεξάνδρ Ντούγκιν. Η συνέντευξη πραγματοποιήθηκε στα αγγλικά. Καλή ακρόαση. Greetings, everybody. I hope you're doing well. It's of great pleasure to be joined today by none other than the political scientist, sociologist, philosopher, thinker, Mr. Alexander Dugin. Mr. Dugin, thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Before we move on, I would like first of all to ask you about the current situation in Ukraine. Could you give us your insight on what's going on there right now?
In Ukraine?
Yes, please.
First of all, we need to understand historical context in order to understand better what is going on right now in Ukraine. We need to make at least a short explanation about what geopolitically, historically is Ukraine. Ukraine is a national state created after the split, after the fall, after the collapse of the Soviet Union. In these borders, in these limits, Ukraine never existed. It wasn't some state, national state, existing before Soviet Union and returning to independence after the collapse of Soviet Union. That was the part of Soviet Union and before of Russian Empire. Administrational province, nothing more, where were united different ethnical and historical and cultural groups. That was just an administrative district called Ukraine. That is province, just province in Russia. Ukraine, that is the periphery and the sound way. Historically, in the beginning of our history, that was precisely the cradle of all three East Slavic peoples of small Russian, Malorossi, White Russians, Belarusi, and Great Russians, Velikorossi. Moscow, and before Moscow, Vladimir was the capital of the Great Russians, only one of the three branches. And before this separation and formation of three branches of the Eastern Slavs, so-called Russians in general, all of our ancestors lived in the territory more or less coinciding with the Ukraine, modern days Ukraine. Mm-hmm. That was called Kievan Rus, Kievskaya Rus, Kievan Rus. But in the history, these three peoples were divided. One part concentrated around the Moscow, around Vladimir and Moscow, and that part is known as Greater Russians, Velikorossi. The other part was mostly to the southwest of this territory. In the western part of modern days Ukraine, they were called Malorossi, small Russians. Okay. And to the north, west north, were situated Belorussia, white Russians. And the destiny, the history of three peoples were different. Great Russians have created huge empire, big empire, Moscovite Empire. That is the Moscow part, the eastern part of our history. That was precisely historically manifested in the Russian Empire. Belarusian were the core of the Lithuanian kingdom, mm-hmm. joined with Poland. And small Russians, this southern western part, under Polish, Poland, and Austria. So, and only one really independent Russian state was formed by greater Russians. And little by little, in the process of growth, greater Russians, Moscovites, began to expand, liberating the other Eastern Slavs, Belarusians, and small Russians from the masters, Polish masters, Austrian masters, Hungarian masters, and so on. And we have we've made re-enter these two peoples inside of this state created by greater Russians. That is the Russia as we know, And Soviet Union was the heir of this greater Russian empire with districts and administrative territories inside of peopled by Slavs or not Slavs, as in the Caucasus and the Middle Asia. And communist Bolsheviks, they have inherited all this territory. And never that was the state, Ukraine, neither Belarus. They were the people, the parts, the branches of the Eastern Slavs, but they never had their own state. And after the fall of the Soviet Union, there appeared for the first time in the history, Ukraine. And in this Ukraine, in this newly created, artificially created state after this the destruction of the Soviet Union, there were two peoples inside of this, as in Belgium and as Belgium. So Eastern Ukrainian and Western Ukrainian. Western Ukrainian were more or less small Russians, more or less. But Eastern Ukrainians were purely greater Russians. These territories were have taken, the Russian Empire, in the Moscovite Empire, was taken from the Turks and peopled by greater Russians normally. So that was a kind of, that never, these territories, the half of Ukraine, from Crimea to the Kharkov, eastern part, all the eastern half of Ukraine belonged to these newly acquired from Turks territories of Russian Empire. So it was the part of greater Russia. And after that, we have liberated the other parts. And the last piece of it was in time of Stalin, taken from the Austria. So the Ukraine consists from these two identities, one of greater Russia, the other of small Russians. And both use normally greater Russian language, so Russian language. And only the Western part, sometimes inside of their households, used as well these Mova, small Russians, Ukrainians, known as Ukrainian language. So that was the language or idiom of minority of the Western part of Ukrainians. So that was more or less the idea. And that was reflected in the elections during 30 years of independent Ukraine, because Eastern part elected one candidate, the Western part the other. And there was the Western identity of Ukraine is much more Eastern Europe identity, but Eastern part of Ukraine is the same identity, absolutely the same as the Greater Russia, because they were the heirs of Greater Russia. In Crimea, not only Crimea, all the territories known as Nova Russia, Nova Russia, from Odessa to the Kharkov, all these territories were acquired by Russian Tsars. And after that, the Tsars had acquired the other Western part. And new Ukraine had a chance historical chance to create, establish the nation state. But they should take in consideration both identities, as Belgium. So, for example, Wallons and Flemish people. So they should hear one part, the other part, combine their interests, because Eastern Ukraine was pro-Russia, Western Ukraine anti-Russia. For the Eastern Ukraine, Stalin was the hero, and Russian Tsars were hero. For the Western part, Hitler was rather hero.
Oh, so, okay.
That is the total split, not only ethnic, but ethnical. They were more or less all of Ukrainians and Russians. We belong to the same brand, the same root ethnically. But historically, we lived centuries under the domination of different political entities. So there, that was how different identities were formed. And we could say that Western Ukrainians is one people with one mentality, was one identity, mm-hmm. and Eastern Ukraine is the other people. And this Eastern Ukrainian people is the same, absolutely the same as Russian people, Tsarist people. And Ukraine, after appearing on the scene, balanced between this either more pro-Russian or more pro-Western identities. Turn within. And Yanukovych was a candidate of the East. Yushchenko was the candidate of the West of Ukraine. But they were not equal. Numbers were more or less equal. But the Western Ukraine was very much more active and supported by globalists and the West. And the global liberal West supported only half of Ukrainian population against the other half. And Russia more or less supported the other half. So these are premises and preconditions of the Ukrainian conflict. Yanukovych was the candidate of the East. Very, very weak, corrupted, not so much pro-Russian, liberal person, mm-hmm. small and involved in corruption. And he was overthrown during the coup d'etat, supported by Joe Biden personally, by Victoria Nuland, by Joe Biden personally. They have financed by George Soros, by Bernard-Henri Lévy. They have supported Western Ukrainian in order to overthrow Yanukovych and to establish totally pro-Western Ukraine on the price of destroying Eastern part of population. And that after Maidan, Yanukovych fled to Russia. And because Crimea was populated much more than other eastern parts of purely greater Russians. Putin declared the readiness to accept, in the case of the referendum or in Crimea, accept as the part of the Russia. Mm-hmm. But that was not solution, because that was only 2 million people. Around 18 million people outside of Crimea belong to the more or less the same Russian identity in the Eastern Ukraine. So when we have made reunification with Crimea, 18 million of people, it's a huge country, was left aside, outside, and under the power of the radically pro-Western, Nazi-oriented Western part of Ukraine, liberal Nazis, anti-Russian, radically anti-Russian, and pro-Hitler, and general, historically.
Okay.
And that was why Donbas people revolted, and they declared already, without our insistence, their independence. Kyiv began to attack them. Russia was obliged to support them as well. In that moment, Trump came to power, and Putin stopped any serious support to the eastern Ukraine for not irritate Trump, who was very peaceful orientated. And Trump was accused to be Putin's spy, so other things. So, but what next? Now, Trump was overthrown in the process of the color revolution inside of United States, and globalists, Atlanticists, once more arrived to the White House. And Biden, who was one of the leading person in preparing the putsch and the coup d'etat in Maidan against Russian, became the president. So he, coming to the White House, he has encouraged Zelensky, new president of this Ukraine, to take back Donbas and after that Crimea. But that was possible, and that is possible only through the war with Russia. Putin doesn't want a war, but he will not let neither Crimea nor Donbas to be taken military, and we have enough power to defend them. But that will not solve the problem, because 18 million of Eastern Ukrainians still are held as hostages of this pro-Western liberal regime. For this reason, we are living in a very, very awkward situation. It is not solution. It is just the beginning, stopped in the middle of the process. And I think that Biden tried not to win back. It is impossible military, and not to go to the war with Russia as full-scale Russian-American war. I don't think he had precisely this idea. He wanted to push Zelensky to attack Donbas republics. Russia would automatically intervene, and after that, Biden would cut Europe from Russia decisively. No Nord Stream 2, Nord Stream 2, nothing. Oh, so that yeah. will that would isolate Russia. And he would just sacrifice Ukrainians in order and let Russian to get involved in the Ukraine on the price of the total demonization of Russia and isolation from Europe. That was idea. And he hesitated, and maybe he is hesitating now, Biden, because there, on one hand, he could receive the total isolation of Russia from the European partner, he could strengthen NATO, he could put more control over Western Europe with such a demonization of Russia, if Russia would be provoked to enter in the Ukraine, but at the same time, he can lose, because if Russia goes far enough, we could restore our rule over almost all Ukraine, whole Ukraine. And that will mean that we have restored our empire, and that will be serious. So Biden, for that, he is balancing now between pushing Zelensky one step more in order to sacrifice him, or to limit just this by threatening Russia that America will be involved, as in Georgia, United States didn't enter in the situation. The same will be with Ukraine. But I think that the price, it is maybe too high to start this provocation, because it, on one hand, it could seriously strike Russia with the sanctions, all sanctions possible, but it could give to Russia the new positive acquirements in the territory and as well and the population, because next time Putin will not limit with the just Crimea. Crimea is ours already. So we would liberate at least the half of Ukraine and maybe more. So, and Biden understands this, and that is where we are now. So and everything depends only on Biden. Zelensky, Putin, nobody influences decision of how the things will develop, because if Zelensky strikes Donbass, Putin will respond. That is mechanically, but Putin will not begin this war. That is the other very we can take on that for granted. So Putin doesn't want to enter the war, but if the war starts, Putin will be there. Our troops will occupy the eastern part of Ukraine. And Ukrainians understand that very well. They don't want to provoke Russians more, because now they control eastern Ukraine more or less. And they will for sure lose it if Russia starts new serious battle in the eastern part.
Perfect. It was really nice hearing your insight on the Ukrainian issue. There has been lots of misinformation on what's going on in Ukraine right now. It's better to know exactly what is happening over there right now, so people can decide for themselves which side to support.
Okay.
Since you talked about Biden, what's the difference in the relationship between the thalassocracy and the tellurocracy, comparing the Trump and the Biden era?
Oh, that is completely different era. So Trump was representative of what I call a liberalism 1.0. So the normal classical liberalism, where the freedom means the possibility to choose everything you want, more or less. So that democracy is the rule of majority, and you could choose freely. Continue tradition or choose the innovation. So that is traditional American democracy, liberal democracy, with a little bit return to the traditional Republican isolationism. So great, make great America great again is the kind of reliance on the inner. Problems, domestic issues, it is stop interventions in different parts of the world is the pre-Wilsonian or traditionally Republican strategy. That was Trump. Trump can or could accept multipolarity. For example, the growth of Russia and independence and China, financial, economical potential can be regarded by Trump as competition, very hard, but competition peaceful, not necessarily war, because Trump was realist in the politics, realist in international politics. He could accept multipolarity if America would have the privileged role among the other poles. And he agrees with that, and he didn't start any war. That is really, he was really realist, pacifist, and domestic-oriented liberal democracy. With Biden, that was aggressive. Liberalism 2.0 that came to power. That is totally new liberalism. This liberalism considers anybody who disagrees with their gender politics, with their agenda of opposite racism and their critical race theory and other points, the option of sexual identity, All these are dogmas. They are not just options or choices. They are absolutely necessary normative dogmas, and everybody who disagrees with them is considered to be racist, fascist, enemy of open society. That is the new turn of liberalism. That is aggressive, attacking, left-wing liberalism, a kind of left-wing, with postmodernism, with dehumanization, post-human agenda, and gender politics. That is a kind of making perversion norm and the norm perversion or crime. And that is totally new term in ideology, in politics. It is aggressive globalization, interventionism, idea to destroy any obstacle on the way of the progress represented by Putin's Russia and Xi Jinping China, because that is the aggressive attack against emerging multipolarity. Trump would accept that, and Biden never. He will try to destroy it at any price. So they intervene in inner politics of Russia with Navalny case. They try to push Zelensky to attack Russia on the Ukrainian front. And Biden will try to destabilize China in the Pacific, in the Uyghurs, in Xinjiang, in the Tibet, and so on and so on. So that Biden wants return to unipolar movement as it was during the 90s. And Trump would accept this de facto multipolarity that was created in during the 20 years of the third millennium. So Trump was realist and Biden is liberal in international relations. And he is globalist and he's neoconservative that tries to save falling down, breaking apart American empire. So he is real colonial, hegemonical imperialist with very special ideology. That is ideology of aggressive, offensive liberalism and individualism and progressism. So in the technology, the high tech, high pharma, big pharma, high tech, that is precisely world governments that tries to be established in spite of all the losses and defeats it underwent during last two decades. And that is different. So now we will experience the new way of colored revolution, interventionism, sanctions, demonization. And I think that is the world is in danger, because this politics to deny the evidence, to not to accept the facts, to insist only on one dogmatic vision of the things, on one dogmatic moral, the moral of left liberal government of United States as the only and unique truth in the world, without, and everybody who challenges that, who contests that, who try to criticize that, immediately is qualified as the fascist or racist, starting from the half of American population what Trump voted. They are deprived of civil rights. For example, one of the Democrats governors has suggested not to sell the tickets to the avion to the people spotted, fixed, remarked, observed to participate in the pro-Trump rally in Washington. Not only those who participated in assault on the White House, but just participants of this rally. So that is incredible. It is the real liberal fascism. So Biden is representative of this imperialist liberal fascism with totalitarian, clearly totalitarian features. oriented not only against outer enemies as Putin and Xi Jinping, but as well against American population. So that is the agony of wounded dragon of unipolarity, and we are dealing with that. It could be, if there is some grit, some mind, some intelligence, I think it will last not long, and it they will avoid the wars. But it is as well probable and highly probable that they, because the beast is wounded, it could theoretically try to attack, because the situation is in total decline for globalists, and they use maybe they could use the last weapons they had, and that is very dangerous.
Thank you for that. Since you talked about more aggression and that America is a wounded animal, what could we say about the American-Israeli aggression towards Iran, and what should the Russian stance be towards that case?
So it is possible because Biden's government is at least at the same level pro-Israel as was the pro-Israel Trump, but Trump avoided direct wars. And Biden could behave differently. So it is quite possible Israel wants war against Iran, but Russia shows that it will be sided with Iran. So next, one more open front line, because if United States would attack Iran, Russia will be on the side of Iran, precisely because Iran represents one other pole of multipolarity, and that is why Russia will intervene on the Iranian side.
So let's move a bit further east, shall we? A few weeks after the Biden election, we had a coup d'etat in Myanmar by the military party. How does the coup d'etat influence the whole region?
Myanmar is very complicated country with different ethnic, political groups, the clans, the tribes inside, more or less of Birmanian origins, but with many different orientations. So I think that the military government that came to power is less globalist, is much more centralist and nationalist power. And we see that the United States started immediately supported the opposition, and they had sent the pro-Soros networks there to act for demonize military junta. But if Biden thinks someone is bad, it almost for sure means that is good guy. If they think there are some victims, there are pure and good guys, they should be the killers of Soros, Bernard Henri Levy, and the partisan of perversion and totalitarianism. So we should just take a look on who Biden's administration indicates as good and bad. And in order to understand the reality, we should just change the signs. So plus and minus, we should exchange them, and we see clearly what is going on. And that is why Russia didn't support the resolution in United Nations Security Council blaming the military coup d'etat. Because if Biden is angry, so everything is going in the right direction. At least that is, but that is mostly general consideration. I don't think that there are real in Myanmar some Bidenites or Sorosites, I doubt it, But there are some forces and networks, they try to use external support of globalists, and they have lost in this political coup d'etat. So let the military government stay there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So since we're in the Eastern Front, I'd like to ask you, how important is an allegiance between the superpower of Russia and the superpower of China right now? And how important is the continuation of the ACO? Furthermore, is Russia afraid of China, or should it be afraid of Chinese power and economic and aggressive imperialism?
I don't think that China is really aggressive, neither imperialist. I think that China is the new pole of multipolarity, one of two already almost accomplished, perfect, completed poles that we have now. Russia and China represent two asymmetric poles of emerging multipolarity. Russia is stronger with its territories, with its resources, and with military power, and with historical challenge to the West. And China is much more stronger with economy, with demography, and with industrial development, and so on. So that is why we are asymmetric. If we work together, Russia and China, we could create the structure to contend American hegemony. And that is main strategical goal of two leaders, two countries. So in only together we could afford to realize, to put into practice multipolar world. If we start to compete with each other, if we start the conflict with each other, that will mean the victory of the West, of the hegemony of globalists. So both of our leaders understand that very well, and in spite of some risks, mostly Russia has dealing with Chinese demographical, economical, and so on, Russia for sure would prefer Russian-China Chinese alliance in the situation of the growing confrontation with the West. The same for China. China depends much more from the market, from the loans, from the... China is much more involved in the global markets, financial markets, but China is under attack, as Russia is, of the same West, and that is why China has no other solution as to rely on Russia. So China could not afford its own growth in the future without some sharing responsibilities with Russia. For example, China is deeply involved in the economy of Iran. China is constructing Belt and Road Initiative, and Russia now is part of this project. When the project Belt and Road started, Russia was avoided, and that is why American globalists supported Belt and Road Initiative.
Okay.
But in the last years, since Putin has changed the main frame of Belt and Road, and I think now Russia and China should be much more allies than competitors, not to speak about enemies. And both our leaders understand that very, very well. And I think it will be continued in the future.
All right. Since you talked about China and Russia, could you elaborate some of the main points of what Eurasianism is, since it's a new term for people who are not familiar with politics or geopolitics? What should the goals of Eurasianism be in the next 10 to 20 years, let's say? And last, I could not skip this, where does Greece and Turkey stand in the Eurasianist plan of yours?
So Eurasianism, it is vision based on, first of all, on geopolitics. I have introduced in the Russian politics, Russian ideology, this term, is the prefix new, neo-Eurasianism, precisely in the moment when ideology, Soviet ideology, collapsed. And our military people, generals, the heads of the secret services were totally embarrassed, confused, because they saw NATO coming in the Eastern Europe and NATO attacking Russia, and Russia had no other ideology. So they couldn't understand why everything is going on. So in Yeltsin's time. So the idea was that in that moment, I have introduced personally myself in the military academy, Eurasianism and geopolitics in the same time. So the vision that there are telesecrecy and telluricracy as geopolitics regards the situation. There is the liberal capitalist civilization embedded in the space and the sea and the sea power, and there is a kind of heroic tradition, military civilization represented in Eurasia and inscribed in space in the heartland, in the Eurasian continent. That were two examples from the past serve to understand the situation better. Rome against Carthage, or Athens against the Sparta in the Greek history. So telesecrecy and telluricracy, the continentalism with heroic values and a kind of force and power, and sea power that is based on the money, on the adaptiveness, on the total and continued change of everything. So the eternity and the time, the identity and creativeness and progress. So that is more or less how geopolitics understand the great war of continent between Eurasia and sea power. But mostly the text written by geopoliticians in the 20th century were from Anglo-Saxon school, and in that vision, Russia and Eurasia and continent was regarded as object to contend, to fragmentate, to control, to not let to get to warm seas and so on. And I have introduced the concept that Eurasia should become subject, not object, subject, a kind of living, thinking, and willing active power. And that has created the balance between Eurasianism and Atlanticism. So, and that was precisely the first guideline for our generals in the beginning of the 90s, when I started to introduce geopolitics in military circles. And now, 30 years later, geopolitics is taught in all Russian universities and institutions. So I won this battle, introducing unknown science that was considered to be pseudoscience on the global level in Russia. And that is reflected in the Putin's politics and our strategy and everything. So Eurasianism is that. But if we accept the concept that Eurasia should be active and not passive, subject and not object, so we understand immediately that it should rely on herself, Eurasia, that it should be sovereign and autonomous. It is impossible without accomplishing reintegration of post-Soviet space. Russian Federation alone could not be Eurasian. So in order to get to the minimal dimension, Russia should integrate post-Soviet space. That is called new Eurasianism or Eurasian, Eurasian Union. So that first application of this geopolitical way of thinking to the reality is to recreate a kind of Tsarist Empire of Soviet Union or Eurasian Union. That's the same. So, and that was has began with Putin already, because Putin has started to do precisely the same. As well, we need to prolong our influence over our borders in order to control the zone, the limits, the limitrophs, and the zones around the frontiers around Russia. That all is inscribed in this Eurasian geopolitics. But and in the beginning, China was considered to be part of the Rimland. Rimland is the zone starting from China, coming to the through Middle East and Caucasus and the Mediterranean to the Europe. It is considered in the classical geopolitics as Rimland, the intermediary zone between Eurasian Russia and sea power and the globalists and the Atlanticists. And idea of the globalists was to integrate all this Rimland under their control in order to suffocate and to contain Russia. But China was much more smarter. Chinese, they have used the possibility, opportunity to open their society, to be involved in the global market, but they have conserved the dominance and the hegemony over inner politics. And they didn't let liberalism, liberal democracy, Western culture to enter in their zone. So they have accepted what made them stronger, and they did decline what would make them weaker. And that was very smart, very wise. And when they came into real competition with the West, they have shown the will to join Eurasia, to be on the continental side. That is the great, great meaning of the concept of the Greater Eurasia that was accepted by Putin and Xi Jinping recently, 3 years ago only. That was new term. So China somehow, in the theory at least, and the strategical theory, joined Eurasia. And we have taken the huge part of the Rimland out of Atlantis' control. The other huge space is India, that is balancing, hesitating between us and United States. The other great space is Iran, the part of Rimland as well. That is decisively rather on our side. Mm-hmm. Turkey was balanced, hesitating as well between NATO and somehow pro-Russian stance in different situation, and politics of Erdogan being nationalist, being expansionist, at the same time is much more pro-Russian with each unperceptibly, not in the open, but in the one agreement with the other step. He is balancing, he is hesitating, but if we consider at length of his rule, he started almost as Atlanticist with Gulen, pro-liberal, and so on. And now he is much more Eurasianist as the other. The same choice between the Eurasia and Atlanticism is open for Europe, because European Union can come a little more to Russia as in time of Schroeder and Schroeder and France in the beginning of the 2000s, they tried to establish Paris, Berlin, Moscow access during the Iraq invasion of Americans. That was a real chance. So because it is geopolitically speaking the other part of the heartland of the Rhineland, it could be under control and all whether of liberals or of Eurasia. And for Greek, the same culturally, religiously, Greek is the part and the center of Orthodox Eastern Christian tradition, and Greek is motherland of all Europe, Western and Eastern, of Russian and German. So Greeks are our common ancestors, but that is culturally in the history. In the reality, the Greece is very small country with not serious amount of sovereignty. And the part of the Western Europe, without serious influence on the Brussels or on Paris or Berlin, Greece today is much more the object of European politics than real sovereign fall. And comparing with Turkey, for example, the power and the force is obviously on the side of Turkey. Turkey possesses much more sovereignty and much greater amount of independence, being as well the part of the NATO, but Turkey take more and more distance in front of the West. And so Greece could not lead today independent politics. For example, as other countries of Eastern Europe. But I think that Greece and Serbia, and maybe up to some level, Romania or Bulgaria, these countries could form with other Eastern European countries and states, could form the real neutral zone in Eastern Europe, neither Atlantist nor Eurasian, but serving a kind of bridge between the two Europe and Eurasia. So that could be a very important mission of greater Eastern Europe project. I'm calling that as such. But if we, for example, if we imagine the possible radical shift of Greek politics towards independence from modern liberal globalist elites, and Russia could accept with the happiness Greece as the part of this continental space. I think that, for example, belongingness to the NATO didn't solve neither Turkish nor Greek problems and could not solve. The same may be, to say realistically, to speak realistically, yes, could be the case in the adherence of the Greece and Turkey to Eurasianism. That will not solve the problem, but what at least could grant Russia could grant defense and support of independence of the Greece in the present situation, as NATO does today. So it is not so important, I think, for Greeks geopolitically to which camp to belong, to the West or to the Eurasia, but on the level of the values, on the level of the moral, religious identity, is obviously that Eurasia Eurasia and Russia is identity of tradition, of the spiritual dignity of our Byzantine heritage. We are heirs of Byzantine Empire, and now we realize the mission of Byzantium that was that has ended after Ottoman Empire. So we, in that sense, on the spiritual, maybe eschatological, religious level, I think that the mission or the destiny of Greeks to return home to their roots that now are defended by us. But that on the spiritual level, on the political or geopolitical level, I could not promise the serious benefits for that. Or only in one situation, Greece can overcome the natural limits of humble dimension of modern Greece state is to play the leading role in reorganizing Eastern European space under influence of and that is as well embedded in the history. So that is quite possible. But Greece, after the liberation from Ottoman Empire, didn't use as well this chance. Greece could be the real pole of attraction to other Orthodox people liberating from Ottoman Empire, but that was lost. So I think that maybe in the near future, Greece will receive the new chance to play the really important geopolitical role as it played during history many times, and I hope it will be the case. In that sense, it could be only on the side of Eurasia. But now I'm set to recognize that Greece rather is playing on the side of Israel, on the side of, yes, of Brussels, on the side of globalist Atlantists, powers, and that is very sad, I think.
Could the Balkan and the Eastern Europe neutral zone idea, as you mentioned, be a similar concept to that of Dimitris Kitsikis' middle space?
I have met Dimitris Kitsikis once in Moscow. That was a very interesting person with very deep ideas. So, but he started from the idea that this middle space between Asia and the West could be the new center. But that contradicts the weights of the existing poles. So I don't think it could be really independent. It will be new Rhineland, where a zone of competing and opposite forces. But if we consider special nature of many Eastern European peoples, Polish, Romanian, Hungarian, Bulgarian, Serbian, Croatian, and other, we could, or Albanian, we could imagine that could, including Baltic states, that could be something important, but not on the level as Dimitris Kitsikis imagines. But his ideas are very, very useful and fruitful, and I would support them because in modern Greece, he represents, as long as I know, the unique case of the author and political analyst and philosopher with clearly geopolitical understanding of the reality. And that is a very, very nice example of correct and responsible thought. And in any cases, I think that this middle zone project could be something, that is the only way for Greece to overcome the modern deplorable state of impotence and absence of real sovereignty and real weight on the international scene. When there was this voting referendum, OHI, to European Union, that was a chance, I think, for Syriza, and for other powers. There was the chance to get out from European Union and to start to actively to reform politics in the Balkans, in the Eastern Europe, and open the real way, open door to Russia, to Eurasia, and to totally new development in issues. Then there was a chance, and Syriza has betrayed almost immediately Varoufakis. They have concluded the new deal with European Union, and they have preferred to serve the global capitalist masters in order to heroic fights of Greek people for real independence, because everybody was on the position how Greece would behave, because the example of the Greece, if the Greece would certainly decide to get out from the European Union, would be maybe exit of Italy and so on, the split, not only Brexit, but that beginning of the decomposition of this globalist Europe and reformation. In that sense, Greece could play a very important role of the leading force of not only of end of these globalist liberal Europe, but in the creation of new worlds, where the Greece could arrive and very important and strategical central line. But it seems to me that now it's almost impossible to repeat, because that was the great chance, and the Greek left has lost it. And Greek illiberal right cannot have such a power in order to do something like that. It is under constant pressure. But interesting that my book, Forced Political Theory, is translated in Greek. Yeah. And it was read with attention by some conservative national politicians. They have visited myself several times, and it could be interesting to repeat OHI referendum, maybe uniting left and right against the European Union, but it is rather improbable in the present situation. But we will see. Politics, it's living thing, and what is impossible today can easily turn into possible tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask you a couple of more questions if you've got some time.
Okay.
What are your thoughts on ethno-nationalism, considering the migration crisis and the introversion as a result of the pandemic in smaller countries like Italy or Greece, as compared to the Russian Federation? And what's your attitude and perspective towards ethnos?
Okay. I have written a big book, manual, that is called Ethno-Sociology. Ethno-Sociology, it is translated into English and published in the United States. And it is translated now in Italian, and that's where I have developed my theory about ethnos, nation, people, using mostly Greek terms. So, for example, a very important difference is between ethnos and Laos, or Laos, or ethnos. So, in my opinion, ethnos is traditional society, mostly rural, folk society, that is a kind of, well, without social structures, without hierarchies, and much more as in a village, in a kind of village, a kind of peasant, peasantry. That is typically ethnic way of organization of life. In the industrialization, in the process of the modernity, the ethnos were destroyed. They were killed, and from the rest of the ethnic community was constructed artificial national unity. And so I oppose the nation and ethnos. So ethnos is traditional way without hierarchy based on collective identity, and nation is artificial bourgeois construction based on individual identity. But between ethnos and nation is modern industrial bourgeois, profane, desacralized version of organization. Between them lies people, Laos. And I have imagined the term Laokratia. Mm-hmm. The idea that the people should have power. Ethnos could not be political reality. A nation is artificial political reality. And it is easy to transform nation is the civil society, because the nation consists from the individual citizens, and civil society is the same nation without national boundaries. So the same nation without boundaries, but the same civil society. So it is easy to get from national state to the European Union or to globalists, precisely because the basic entity, unit of normative unit of the nation is the same as in civil society. In the case of ethnos, it is totally different unit. It's collective identity, but without political structure. And Laos is, in my opinion, the people, narod in Russian. That is a category never properly thought in the politics. It should be the real subject of the politics. And Laos, it is the ethnos with the destiny, with hierarchy, ethnos that could be composed from different ethnical group, not necessarily totally homogeneous, but possessing some cultural and historical identity, and most of all, the common future. So it is project. The Laos, it is a kind of hierarchically organized ethnos or group of ethni in order to accomplish some historical mission. That is Laos. I think that Laos existed in Byzantine Empire, in Roman Empire, in Russian Empire. Laos, that was the people. And ethnical group were subjacent to this Laos. They existed as well as a part of this Laos, but mostly in the peasant agrarian level of this society. On the top of Laos were the political and religious elite, ruling class, not necessarily belonging to the same ethnos on the bottom, but taking responsibility for the future of Laos. So elite and masses were united in Laos. And this Laos was destroyed with the arrival of modernity. Was purposely destroyed and replaced by nation. Now there is the shift from nation to the civil global society, and that means destruction of all the rest of any kind of ethnic homogeneity. And the end of Laos, because end of the states, of the cultures, and that is the logical result of individualism, of liberalism. And I think that mass migration represents the artificial strategy to destroy finally ethnical and identity of okay. of the society. So it is strategy, not only just spontaneous phenomenon. It is organized, and the people like Soros, like Bill Gates, all the globalists, like Biden, they use mass migration in order to achieve their conscious goal to destroy the peoples and the ethnos. And that is why it is absolutely negative phenomenon, but not the immigrants are negative. Negative are those who are masters of this modern process, who not only direct and control them, but they provoke almost always, they provoke them. That is something artificial. We could not stop or limit mass migration without destroying the people and the structures, Biden, Soros, NATO, liberalism, globalism, their education, their parliaments, their puppet like Syriza and other liberals or right or left liberals serving their masters. We could not achieve or limit the immigration without big, great global revolution against them. Conservative revolution. So that is the fight. We should not say, oh, let us limit the number of people coming from Middle East to Greece. It is impossible. We need the Soros first. First, we should cut the head of the dragon. So it is just the results. We could not fight against consequences without hit first the main reason, the causes of all that. So, but the cause is the modernity, is the liberalism, globalism, ideological attitude and paradigm that is at the top and the algorithm of the modern society. First, we should overcome them, and there will be no immigration, and we could restore not ethnical purity, it's impossible, but restore the peoples, to restore laocracy, in order after to make the condition to ethnical community flourish and prosper. And that is my understanding of this process. It is very complicated and difficult things, ideological. So migration is not social phenomenon. It is about ideology of the ruling globalist elite. And without winning and destroying this elite, first of all, spiritually, and after that, institutionally, we could not arrive at the solution, because those who try to solve the problem are at the sources of this problem. They make this immigration as a fact. They have created mass immigration, and they control and they provoke it.
And to sum things up in a more revolutionary tone, what would your advice be to younger people that try to escape from modernity, liberalism, and materialism, to come closer and embrace more traditional values and get away from the globalist hands?
So, first of all, for the young men, I would suggest young, sincere and strong and devoted to the real, to the people, to the values, to the tradition, to the identity, young men and women can fall easy victims of globalist strategy if they don't pay enough attention to the philosophy. In today's world, there is only one power, the power of ideas. And when they present that they have money, they have technology, they have institution, they have police, army, all this is illusion. What they control in the reality, it is the mind. They control the soul. They control the soul. They control the epistemology. So our revolution should start with a philosophy. And I think that philosophy, it is not about time, it is about eternity. For that reason, I think that the revolution starts with Plato. So let us return, all of us, to the Plato, to the Aristotle, in order to understand their heritage not as something belonging to the past, but something that belongs to the eternity. For example, I'm studying Greek language in order to understand Aristotle, Plotin, Plato, and Proclus, and Simplicius, and all other great, first of all, Greek thinkers. I think that philosophy is Greek. And when I find something very interesting in Latin, in French, in German, in Anglo-Saxon, it is for sure will be Greek. There is only one philosophy. It is Greek philosophy. So don't forget it. So I think that the only real weapon and only the alpha and omega of our revolution should be philosophy. It starts with philosophy, it ends with philosophy, it passes through philosophy. So I suggest, and if we are not enough clever, if we're not enough smart, if we're not enough prepared in the philosophy, it's too easy in modern technology to enslave us. Only philosophy makes us free. So I suggest start for philosophy, and after that, to defend traditional value. Defend eternity in the philosophy, defend eternity in the church, and the great and more rich Orthodox Christian Greek tradition. That is immense treasure, the real and profound treasure. And that is priceless, absolutely priceless. So I suggest to for the avant-garde of the revolution for Greeks, because for you it's easier than for all of us to read your classics. And I have published the book Political Platonism, about how great and how actual and how fitting to the reality all ideas of Plato are. So I have this dedicated to Aristotle many courses of my lectures, and YouTube has banned my lecture to Aristotle because they understand where the real danger is. The danger is the thought. The danger is Plato. Let us attack them with Plato first. Let us rediscover metaphysical and intellectual dimension of great Orthodox Christian tradition as well, your heritage, your patrimony, Greek patrimony. So let us discover the glory of Byzantine Empire. Let us reaffirm the glory of symphony between the powers, the spiritual and secular. And let us restore at least the image, and let us defend that. That is why I am in charge of the site that is called Katechon.com. So that is Greek name, and for us Russian, that is the word that has everything in it. So let us return to being Greek, to be Greeks. So that is main suggestion. And after that, I think that Greek young people should discover traditionalist author as René Guénon, Julius Evola, and after that, armed with the metaphysical weapon of Platonism and traditionalism, we should start to prepare the big global revolution on the total, on the planetarian scale. We need to overthrow them. We need to defeat them, and we need to use every means we could get access to in order to end with their domination. That is eschatological, apocalyptic struggle. On our side are the angels, on their side are the demons. So I consider modern world as opening revelation of the real moving powers of the history described in the apocalypse. So we need to rediscover the mythological level of the reality and live as heroes, of great Greek tragedies and myths, and as martyrs and warriors and heroes of our Christian history.
Mr. Dugin, I'd like to thank you very, very much for this interview. It was really enlightening. I hope the people listening to us will find it enlightening as well.
Thank
you very much. Hope to talk to you again sometime.
It was great.
All the best to you.
All the best.
Good evening.
Good evening.